Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
I'm Manny.
And this is your new Comics Wednesday episode for August 12th, 2020. Obviously, things in the comic book industry are looking a little bleaker than they were just a few days ago. We had the news that DC's laid off supposedly up to a third of their editorial staff. A lot of long-time names that have been there for decades, if not years, and I don't know. I think that the comic book landscape is obviously changing. People are spouting crazy theories like they always do about DC. Disney's gonna buy them. Blah blah. I'm there. You know what? You got to take all this stuff with a grain of salt. You gotta be logical. You gotta think about this from the standpoint of a multi-billion-dollar conglomerate. Like AT&T, which now owns DC. I said it from the beginning. When the merger went through, I was worried for DC because the bigger the corporation, the less likely the decisions that corporation makes are going to be good for a creative endeavor. So This writing has been on the wall for a long time. I think these cuts would have still happened. Were things maybe cut deeper than they would have been because of the pandemic? Yeah, probably so, but that's not to say these cuts wouldn't have happened anyway. So we're not going to get into it any more than that here, because I want to talk about the books that are coming out tomorrow, and I want to focus on the positive on this episode. I will say, if you're listening to this on Wednesday, pay attention to our social media today on Twitter and Instagram. I will be guesting on a YouTube channel for Dark Knight Nation, where I will let fly with what I know, what I've been told by people that I've talked to that have the ability to know these things, because they either work for DC or you know, they're people that I trust that know, they've been in contact with DC, or just things I'm speculating on based on experience. So if you want to know more about what's going on with DC and what I expect from the future, and you know, wild speculation. Some of it's going to be wild speculation. If you want to know about the causes behind this and why DC Comics as a publishing entity is not going away, and Disney's not going to buy them, and Warner Brothers and AT&T are not going to sell them, I'll be talking about all that stuff on that YouTube Live later. So feel free to go and check that out. Like I said, it's going to be live. You'll be able to ask questions. You'll be able to comment on things that we're talking about. So feel free to do that. But right now we're going to focus on comics that are coming out today, August 12th. There are tons of great books. That's the thing, right? Like, I want to celebrate what great comics are coming out right now. I mean, it's been a while since, like, every book I read was like, this is good. This is great. I really, like, you know, usually there's one or two. Usually I read about 10 to 12 books in preparation for this, and then I pick the five or six, sometimes four, if they're, you know, just depending on what volume are coming out, how many issues or what have you, if it's a heavy week, if it's a light week. And I talk about the ones that I think people are most interested in hearing about. Obviously, if Manny joins, then we can kind of divide those up. And sometimes he's interested in reading some stuff that I'm not necessarily. Sometimes I have time to read the stuff he's covering too, so I can comment on it. But usually it's like, in the books I read, between what, as few as four or five, as many as 12, there's going to be a stinker or two. I read 8 books, man, no stinkers. They were all above average comics. So there's really quality stuff coming out right now. And so it's kind of sad and weird that we've had this news. And the other part, of course, being DC Fandome, which is next weekend. And my understanding is a lot of the people that handled all the logistics and put all that together, all of them are the ones that are being laid off. So I've heard some people talking about these people are gone already. That's not the case. They're being laid off, but they're being let go with a lot of notice. 90-day notice is my understanding. So nobody lost their job on Monday. Nobody was like, okay, go home, you know, and don't come back. That's not the case. If they choose not to come back, you know, that's on them. They probably want to keep getting paid, though, is my thought for the next 3 months. So I say all that to say that Fandom's going to be a little strange. A lot, some of the stuff has already been recorded before this news dropped. Some of it has not yet been recorded. So it's going to be weird. It's going to be really weird. And the only other thing that I'll say about it is there was so much hope. And I heard a lot of people talking about when you looked at DC Fandom when they were promoting it, it was like this long list of Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
Star Wars scroll names, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, there's Dan Abnett's name right next to Gal Gadot's name. And people say, oh, the comics creators and stuff are finally getting equal billing with all the movie and TV stuff. And then this happens. So it's going to be a little awkward. There's going to be some growing pains. Things like this happen. And I don't want to diminish or, discount any of the pain that anybody over at DC who's affected by this is feeling. You know, these are, like the comics are not, like the characters are not, like the stories are not, these are real people who were doing a job they loved, because trust me, nobody gets into comics to get rich, especially not if they're working in editorial. Not only do you not get rich, you have even less chance of making money or becoming famous than a creator does. It's really kind of a thankless job. You get very little credit when something goes right, but you can be blamed when something goes wrong, and you're an unsung hero. So these people that were working in editorial, they were doing it because they love comics. So just like anybody, when anybody loses their job, it's not something to celebrate. So I don't want to discount it, you know, at all. So it's a tough time, but these things do happen in all industries, not just the comic industry, especially when we're seeing an economic slowdown and there's a lot of other factors going on, you know, both financial and societal and political. So hopefully everybody lands on their feet and we come out of this okay on the other side. I guess that remains to be seen. So enough about that. Let's talk about some great books. Manny, what do you have up first?
I have IDW's Judge Dredd False Witness number 2. This was by Brandon Easton, art by Kay Zama, and colors by Eva de la Cruz. So just a little background on the book. It focuses on a character named Matthias Lincoln, who, although is a very skilled individual, he's kind of working as a courier. And he has delivered something to a high bidder that is supposed to be a quote-unquote aphrodisiac, but it turns out that it is some sort of chemical that has the ability to turn humans into it literally says puddles of goo. And so after confronting this high roller, who, by the way, is such a cliche name, his name is Dr. Filth. He finds out that they're actually using this to dissolve people who have mutant abilities and then extract that gene in order to provide a extended life and physical capabilities to the higher end cities of Mega City. So the book takes place, issue 2 takes place right as he's finding out, seeing this vat of people like being disintegrated, and the guy's like, yeah, well, you delivered it and now you know, so you're an accessory, deal with it. And at the same time, in issue 1, he had gotten into a scuffle with some protesters where Judge Dredd has showed up with drones to try and calm the situation, but in doing so he damaged the box where he had this chemical in, and when he headed back to the station, they analyze, I guess, something, and they figure out that kid was carrying that compound, and so now they're trying to track it down. It's honestly kind of, it feels like something out of the 80s, something, the story is really, really dense, and I think it's overly complicated for no reason, but the fact of the matter is, I don't even know why I have such an affinity for Judge Dredd. Even the Stallone movie, man, like the Carl Urban one was so good, the one that they released on Netflix. But I will watch that, the Stallone movie, a couple times, with the one with Rob Schneider, and like a lot of the books that come out with Judge Dredd are just so like not very well, like, developed, and the stories are also, like, wacky in Mega City. But man, like, something about just, like, I guess the extravagance of the wealth between the actual citizens of Mega City and then everyone else, and then Judge Dredd always, like, in the middle, because he's supposed to be that you know, exactly, I was gonna say that, I am the law. And but at the same time, he always ends up breaking the law because he'll side with citizens and things like that. So it's really interesting. As I'm reading this, I'm like, why do I love this so much? And you know, maybe it's just the outfit. The outfits are super cool, but if you're a fan of the property, I think you'll enjoy it. If you're not a fan of the property, it might be a little bit of hard to stick with.
I am the law. Who did you say wrote it again?
It's Brandon Easton.
Brandon Easton. I've heard that name before. I wonder if I've read something he's done. Yeah, I never got into Judge Dredd. I did see the Stallone movie. I don't remember why I saw it. But he's one of those characters. Obviously, he's been around forever. And a couple years ago at a San Diego Comic-Con, I watched Lee Bermejo draw a Judge Dredd who, you know, if you know Lee's art style, you know, super realistic and visceral. It was, like, awesome. It was so awesome to watch him draw this Judge Dredd. His helmet was, like, all cracked and everything. It was really cool. He had, like, holding his pistol up and it was smoking.
He's a cool, like, character.
Yeah, yeah. So one of these days I might get into him. I just never have. And I've heard good things about the Carl Reamer movie. I've never saw it. Did it only get released on Netflix? I thought it got released in theaters, too.
I don't know. Where I first discovered it was on Netflix.
Yeah, I think it did get released in theaters. And like I said, I heard really good things. So, all right. Well, since you talked about an independent book, I'll start off with an independent book. Also, I'm going to talk about Join the Future, number 4, from writer and creator Zach Kaplan. Art is by Peter Kowalski. Colors by Brad Simpson. And letters by Hassan Otsamani El Howl. I know I butchered that last name. The last name is Otsmane - Elhaou. So, for those not familiar with Join the Future, it's a story that Zach Kaplan has been telling about sort of the haves and the have-nots, big city versus rural towns, if you will. So in the future, there's these mega cities, and they recruit people. Apparently, there's some advantage to having the greatest population. And if you live in the city, you're given everything, basically. You have basic universal income, and you can go to school for free and choose if you want to work in, you know, medical industry or agricultural or service industry or tech, or, you know, there's different things you can choose from. You also get health care, and there's all these perks. And on the surface, it sounds like, well, yeah, sure, why, you know, sign me up, why wouldn't you want to live there? And then throughout the course of the series so far, what we've seen is that apparently it's not so much that you give up your freedoms. I mean, once you're in the city, you can't really leave because you sign a contract to go and live there. You agree to live there in perpetuity. But like I said, it's not that you give up your freedom, but you don't even realize what you've given up. There's talk of the fact that, you know, the food doesn't taste as good. Everything is, you know, processed foods, and people don't bother to look up at the sky to see the stars because you can't see any because of all the city lights. But it's not that people are in the city looking up at the sky and thinking, oh, that sucks, you can't see the stars. They don't even realize it's gone. They don't even realize what they've given up. So it's certainly a way of life and a way of freedom and kind of that entrepreneurial spirit that you've that's missing, that people don't even realize, and kind of that, you know, American grit that people don't realize. So when the series starts off, we meet some people in a small town who are trying to hold out against these big cities that then, you know, come in and basically recruit all the people, bring them into the city, and then send these giant robots off, and they literally terraform the land and get rid of the old cities. So there's a lot of old cities that don't exist anymore, or they're underwater, and everything's been reclaimed by nature, basically. So on the surface, it sounds like a really cool idea, but as you go along and you start reading it, you start to realize, hey, what's being given up here may be something that's not worth losing. You know, certainly some independence. And also, you just, these recruiters that come out and recruit for these big cities, right away you just don't trust them. You know, they're like snake oil salesmen. They just seem kind of slimy and you know, hucksterish, and you feel like you can't trust them. So at the end of the first issue, we see the town being attacked, and eventually the young girl in the story is basically the only survivor of the town that doesn't give in, you know, doesn't want to go and be with the city, doesn't want to live in the city. Her father was the sheriff, and you know, he was killed. Her younger brother was killed, and so she wants revenge, and she wants to be free and be allowed to make her own choices. So that's kind of been the story so far, and we've sort of seen the choices that she's made and some deals that she's made and some training she's received to try to accomplish her mission. And then at the end of issue 3, we saw her kind of get waylaid when she first is out on her own trying to undertake her mission. So that's where issue 4 starts off. And it's pretty fast-paced and action-packed from there. I can't really talk about anything that happens other than to say it's fast-paced and action-packed. And, you know, she is in the hands of the enemy when the issue starts. But anything else that I would say about it is going to be a spoiler. And I know you guys want us to be super vague when we give these reviews, because you've told me that, and you want them to be spoiler-free, and I 100% agree. I want you to be able to go out there, pick up the books, read them, and enjoy them for yourself. So the only thing I will say is that the art is spectacular by Peter Kowalski. The story that Zach is telling is very compelling, and it's also so interesting. He's one of the best at telling these stories where you think the narrative is going to push you in one direction. Like, you think it's going to be like, oh, these are the good guys, or this is the side I'm going to identify with most. And then gets flipped and you realize, oh, no, wait, there's this other thing, you know, that I didn't think about. And like when the series starts off and you're reading, you know, open up the first couple pages and you're reading about this city, I'm like, sign me up, man. Like, yeah, I can like basically sit around all day and like work on a computer or play video games or you know, not worry about healthcare or food or income and that kind of thing. Like, yeah, I'm all for that, you know. And then as the story goes on, you realize, you know, the things you're giving up without even realizing it. And that's where you start to think, oh, maybe this isn't so cut and dry as you once might think it is. So like I said, it's a great story. I really can't see wait to see what's going to happen next, because at the end of issue 4 we do see something that happens that looks like we might be ready to face a big showdown in issue 5, and I'm not even sure, I can't imagine it's going to go more than 5 or 6 issues, at least not for the first volume. So we're getting pretty close to the end here of the first one, and man, I really recommend this book. If you haven't checked it out, it reads pretty quick. It is pretty fast paced. You probably could read the first 4 issues in like under an hour. But the art is spectacular. And the other thing that I want to mention about the visuals is the colors. The colors by Brad Simpson. I don't know that I've seen Brad's work before. If I have, it probably was at Aftershock, another book. But being that the majority of this book takes place in the wilderness, because we've not really seen much of the cities other than in like flashbacks or little vignettes, you know, little advertisements and such. We haven't actually, you know, followed any characters that live in the city. Everything is is lush and green and earthen, or in case of waterfalls, very blue. So there's a couple pages where you just look at what this guy does with the colors over Peter Kowalski's line work, and you're just like stunned. There's particularly one splash page in this book where the background is a city with skyscrapers and such, but the land has started to reclaim. And so you've got, you know, all kinds of undergrowth and moss and ivy and such crawling up the sides of these skyscrapers. It's raining, so you've got that in the foreground. There's lightning in the background. And it's just, it's such a great visual in terms of the line work and the vista being kind of impactful, and then with the colors over the top of it, with these dark blues from the stormy sky and the greens over these skyscrapers. It's really, really cool. Like, super, super good art. This might be the best art I've ever seen on a Zach Kaplan book. Like, it's that, and that's saying something, because, you know, we had some great color work and line work on Eclipse as well, and Port of Earth for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the other one that was Lost City Explorers? Lost City Explorers was really good, mm-hmm. too. So, but yeah, this is absolutely spectacular. It's so good. So, and we'll probably have Zach on to talk about it once we get done with the first arc and see how it all went down. I hope that the slowdown and such in sales with the pandemic didn't affect it too badly, because it's a really great book. So, all right, Manny, I'm gonna pop open my Starbucks double shot of energy here. What are you?
What?
It's late, man. I'm probably gonna regret this when I try to go to sleep later. But
I'm drinking a giant Coke right now too. So
let's see.
Get that caffeine in.
Caffeine. All right. What do you got up next?
I got Aftershocks Animosity 28. This is part 4 of their King of Texas arc. It's created and written by Marguerite Bennett, art by Elton Tomasi, colors by Juancho. So if you've been keeping up with this, the King of Texas arc has been crazy. There has been this group of people and animals that have been pretty much kind of doing like a Julius Caesar type Colosseum battles, and Sandor is actually trying to help a friend out while everybody else is actually trying to break out the lemur. I forget his name. And at the same time, he's dealing with kind of the fact that Jesse knows about, you know, what has an idea of what he did to her parents. So this is the aftermath of I'm not gonna go too much into it, because kind of like he was just talking about the previous book. I'd kind of rather it be read, because it's a really, really good arc of how they solve that. But this is the aftermath for that issue. And they arrive at a place that's kind of like it's called Safari Park. It's in the desert where it's like a safe haven for humans and animals, where they can relax. They can even stay there for a long term time if they want, but they are aware that as soon as the Kings of Texas figure out that they're missing, that they're going to be coming after them. So at some point they're going to have to get a move on, or risk having to go to war when they try and get revenge. This issue is kind of a wrap up of everything that happened in that arc, and then also it's for now actually a wrap up of the series, as in the, without giving anything away, in the back of the book there's a quick little note from the Aftershock team that they are going to be announcing what's next for Animosity soon, but for the time being, this is where they're going to tie it up with the bow. The issue does leave you on a cliffhanger, and it is a big cliffhanger when it comes to the relationship between Jesse and Sandor. And you also get to see kind of what some of the other members of the group are up to. And it's a really, really easy paced issue. It's nothing out of this world happens like it has in so many issues of Animosity, where it's just crazy events that take place. This one is super chill. And like I said, it just wraps up the entire arc. If you've been reading the series, it's definitely a change of pace from the last few issues, and it's just enjoyable. Nothing too special about it.
Well, hopefully it does come back, not like Clone that ended on a crazy cliffhanger. But usually it's one of their better selling titles, so I'm kind of surprised.
Right? They've been selling this book since 2016. So.
Without really much of a break. And you wonder, like, maybe Del Torre is the one that needs a break. I mean, he didn't even... Usually he
has... He hasn't been doing the artwork for a couple of issues, actually. I think this entire arc, I don't believe he's been on there.
Yeah, so I wonder if he's busy doing something else, or...
Maybe working on Super Zero? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, so I guess we'll have to wait and see what goes down with that. So, all right. Up next, I have a DC book to talk about. It is Green Lantern, Earth 1, Volume 2, written by Karina Bechko and Gabriel Hardman. The art is by Gabriel Hardman, and the colors are by Jordan Boyd, with letters by Simon Boland. And man, oh man, I really liked the Green Lantern, Earth 1, Volume 1, because it was... For those that didn't read it, it was still Hal Jordan getting the Green Lantern ring, but he wasn't chosen because he was without fear, or he had the ability to overcome great fear or any of that. It just so happened, like, he was the one that was there at the time. And so he was the one that got the ring. And it really gave this, like, everyman perspective, you know, of just anybody could be Green Lantern, anybody could have the power. And when you receive the galaxy's most awesome weapon and you're just an average person, what can that do for you? What, you know, does it bring out the heroic side of you? Can you learn how to overcome adversity and you know, be somebody who aspires to something more? And so it was really cool. And I really enjoyed it. So this volume, volume two of Green Lantern Earth 1 introduces John Stewart as a lantern as well. He actually becomes a yellow lantern, which I'm not spoiling, that's in the solicits. But how that happens is so much different. The whole yellow lantern thing is vastly different than anything that happened in the regular DC universe. 3 years actually have gone by since the end of volume one. So we see that Hal Jordan has somewhat established himself on Earth. Earth is starting to try to make its way into the galaxy and in the solar system in terms of having what's the word I'm looking for here? Having relations with other species, you know, trade relations and stuff like that with aliens and trying to gain technology and you know, start to get out there and explore. So that's kind of the background and the setting. And then the things that happen in this volume, although it's 3 years past and Hal Jordan has established himself, they do tie in closely with the things that we saw in volume one in terms of the Manhunters and the Guardians and some of that classic Green Lantern lore that anybody who's familiar with the you know, the regular Green Lantern and the way that, you know, that whole Green Lantern core and that whole corner of the DC universe works, all that's familiar here. But it's, again, it's set in the Earth One corner of the DC universe, which is a much more realistic kind of look. Things aren't quite so fantastical as they are in the regular DC universe. But this is just super fantastic. Like, it's so good. Like I said, I really enjoyed the first volume for that everyman feel and for the reimagining, and it did feel somewhat realistic. Like, it, you know, it could happen. But it didn't blow me away. Like, I enjoyed the first volume and I thought it was above average, but it was good, but not great. You know, it just, it felt like there was something missing. There was a spark there. I feel like this is great. I feel like this is a step above. I feel like what Karina and Gabriel did in that first volume, they already knew what they were going to do in their second volume. And I'm pretty sure they did, because I think I asked them that exact question at San Diego Comic-Con last year. And they said, yeah. I asked them about it. At that time, their second volume hadn't been greenlit yet. I think the sales weren't all in everywhere for volume one. And they said, yeah, but, you know, based on sales, we already know, you know, what we would do. And so now that they've established everything and that we've taken the time jump to go 3 years, now they really get to kind of spread their wings, so to speak, and really tell this great, awesome story. You know, John Stewart, Hal Jordan, the Corps, the Manhunters, the Guardians, the Yellow Lanterns. It's really, really good. It's been a while since I've read a story of this length, a comic of this length, where I couldn't put it down. Like, it's 144 pages, hardcover, like all the Earth ones come out in hardcover first. And it was like, I literally couldn't stop reading it. You know, usually I don't get that much uninterrupted time to read. And I think I actually did have a couple of work calls while I was reading this, but I immediately went right back to it. Didn't get up and go do anything else or you know, check email or anything. It was just like, man, I want to know what's going to happen next. And like, super compelling. The art by Gabriel Hardman is much like the story itself. It's kind of down to earth. It's visceral. It's realistic. It suits the story and the feel, and especially suits sort of the temperament of the Hal Jordan that they've created. He's quite a bit different than the Hal of the regular DC universe, especially the way that Hal has been in the recent Green Lantern book by Grant Morrison, where he's sort of arrogant and has this swagger. This is very much the everyman Hal that we saw in the first volume. And if anything, in this second volume, he's more sure of himself, but he still feels relatable. He still feels like, you know, that neighbor next door that you could count on for a favor, despite the fact that he has this, you know, really, really powerful weapon. It hasn't, you know, gone to his head. He doesn't put himself above anybody or anything, and he still has that heroism at his core that pushes him to always do the right thing. So just really, really good. He almost has like a Superman quality to him, where there's like some innate goodness in him that maybe wasn't there, at least not completely, when we met him in the early on in volume one. But it seems that with volume two and the 3 years that have passed, he's grown into that. He's grown comfortable in his role as Green Lantern and knows what he has to offer. So highest possible recommendation. This book is awesome. So, so good. And I have no idea with the recent announcements at DC if we're going to get more Earth One stories or not. But man, I sure hope so. I sure hope that this sells like gangbusters, and Karina and Gabriel get to tell more stories about this version of Green Lantern. So please, everybody, go out there and pick it up. It's definitely worth your time. And if you can't afford it in hardcover, then when it comes out in softcover, then pick it up then. And if you're like me, maybe you'll pick it up in both and give the softcover away as a gift to somebody, because it's really spectacular. So, and if you haven't read the first volume, I don't think it's 100% necessary. Like, certainly you can go and read it, and it is good, like I said, but if you're not sure and you want to pick this up and read it, and then if you like it, go back and pick up the first volume, I think that you could read them in that order too. I don't think there's anything that happens in this story, in this volume two, that you have to have read volume one to understand. Like I said, there are some things that it calls back to it, but it's explained enough that you can pick it up if you didn't read the first one and enjoy this for what it is. It's very much a self-contained story. So really, really spectacular. What do you have up next, Manny?
I also have a DC book up next. I have Detective Comics 1025. Tales from the Joker War Attack on Wayne Enterprise. This is by Peter J. Tomasi and art by Kenneth Rockfort with Dan Brown on colors. Let me tell you, this issue of Detective is action-packed. And I thought it was a lot of fun. It actually features Batwoman more than anyone else. And she's doing her part in trying to calm the situation in Gotham with all of these Joker, what do you want to call them, soldiers or henchmen or whatever, running around the city. And in this case, she's going to focus on an area that she describes as a high ground, where a lot of the Jokers are keeping the police officers at bay because they're launching mortars and they have machine guns and all kinds of things that just are just pinning everyone down. And so as the police is trying to kind of take the hill again, she's doing her part to distract everyone and so that they can gain control of the area. Unfortunately, back at Wayne Enterprises, we already know that Lucius Fox is under the control of the Jokers, or the Joker, thanks to that like weird acupuncture toxin stuff that, I mean, he looks really, really just off-putting in this issue, and it, like almost uncomfortable the way that Rockford draws him, and kudos to that, because he did a good job at kind of expressing that madness in his face. And so with the Jokers being defeated one by one by Batwoman and the police, they deploy bat drones to be precise, to try and calm the situation there for the Jokers. And they are met with the arrival of Batman, who then decide that the best course of action is to try and take back Wayne Enterprises, as well as destroy the 3D printers that are able to produce the drones at a high rate. And I don't think I want to spoil the rest of it, because I kind of I'm gonna be honest with you, Jace. I kind of shook my head at his solution for this, because it just seems like no matter what you throw at Batman, there's always a bigger car, and I couldn't help myself but chuckle a little bit, but I enjoyed it. It was fun. It was a little bit different because some of the other issues for Joker War I have been really kind of depressing lately, with obviously they, you know, you have to kind of set the mood. This is where we are in the storyline. Joker has taken over. We had that issue of Batgirl where Joker and her have that long conversation. He's in a way zombified people in the last Batman issue, and he's taken all of his money. Harley Quinn had a throat slashed. What else can go wrong? This is a nice little issue, nice little action-packed issue of Batman and Batwoman kind of, you know, just kicking ass. And just, you know, some really good stuff happened in it, I think. And I'm ready for more. So kudos to them.
All right. I have another DC book up next. It's Wonder Woman 760 by writer Mariko Tamaki. We have art by Mikhail Yanin, colors by Jordi Belair, and letters by Pat Brousseau. This is continuing the Tamaki Yanin reboot. Well, I won't say reboot. Just their run on Wonder Woman, I guess, where we're really seeing kind of a different take, a fresh start, a great time to jump on. So 759 sold really, really well. In fact, it went back to for a second printing. I think a lot of that was on the strength of this new direction and the popularity of Mariko Tamaki and what she's been able to do recently on some of the young adult stuff that DC's putting out, as well as her work in the comics. Mikhail Yanin, coming off Batman and his run with Tom King, which was very well received. And plus, 759 had the first appearance of a new character who the next, I think it's the next issue, 761, might be 762, but I think it's 761, is going to show up as a villain, and her name is Liar Liar. Well, her, once the story actually came out, once the issue actually came out, then and we saw the solicit come out for 762, and we learned that that character was actually introduced in 759. Then the speculators got involved, right? And then the book sold even more. So, good and bad. I kind of wish that hadn't happened. I kind of wish it hadn't necessarily been spoiled, because I want to be sure that the people that are going to buy 759 because they want to read it have a chance to get it. And now it's like a $10 or $15 book already, and it just came out a few weeks ago. So you will have a second printing. You'll have a chance to pick it up and read it. But, you maybe feel a little bit like you missed out, but you shouldn't, because you can get that second printing, and the story is fantastic. So we know that the last issue ended with Wonder Woman confronting Maxwell Lord. We get that resolved right away in the first few pages of this. And when I say it's resolved, I mean we see what happens. There are still questions to be asked. I'm still not sure, because of the way it goes down. You kind of think one thing, but at the same time, you sort of doubt yourself and doubt what your eyes are telling you, because we did see in 759 that there are people that are being, I don't want to use the word brainwashed, but they're seeing things that aren't there, right? They're being led to believe reality is one thing when in fact reality is something completely different. And, that whole situation with the woman, behind the wheel of her car, and she was, driving into oncoming traffic, thinking she was driving on the right side of the road, taking her kids to get ice cream. Because of that woman's behavior is exactly why Wonder Woman went to Maxwell Lord, because it's exactly the kind of thing she expects from Max, because that's basically what his powers are. So I love that he's the first villain we're getting in this run from Tamaki and Yanine, because other than like Cersei and Cheetah and maybe Ares, you can't really name too many Wonder Woman villains. And I think, part of what makes a hero popular is that they have a colorful and diverse and large stable of villains that you think of as their villains, right? So it's part of the reason people love Batman. We've said it, thousands of times on this podcast that he has kind of the best stable of villains. Superman's probably next, and then maybe Flash. They're memorable. You remember them. And that's not to say that Wonder Woman hasn't fought tons of people over the years. But again, like who stands out, right? You only, obviously Cheetah is probably the first one that comes to everybody's mind. And then maybe Cersei or Ares, because of her connection to the gods. Beyond that, you're kind of left scratching your head going, I don't really know. So I love that they're introducing a new villain that can maybe be a part of that. And I love that they're bringing back Maxwell Lord, because obviously, there's history there with Wonder Woman and Max. And to have him firmly established as a Wonder Woman villain, I think would be cool. So you're yet to see exactly how he may be involved. Like I said, we do see what goes down between him and Wonder Woman in the first couple of pages, but we're still left with a lot more questions than answers. It's a pretty fast-paced issue, a lot of action. That's one thing that we haven't seen a lot of so far in the run from Tamaki and Yanine is Wonder Woman as Diana. We've gotten very little of that. So I am curious to see kind of what that take will be, or will she kind of always be Wonder Woman? I do kind of like when we get a little bit of the civilian side of her and get to see her friends and her doing kind of some, normal everyday things. But so far it's been pretty much fast-paced action the whole time. And it's Mikaela Yanine art, so it's super spectacular. Although it's a little bit of a different style than I'm used to seeing from him. I can't really put my finger on it if it seems a little softer or what exactly is different. I mean, I'm so used to seeing him when he illustrates fighting scenes doing like the double and triple exposures where, you know, we see somebody like flipping through the air and we see their different poses as they flip. There's none of that. He has several opportunities to give us kind of that style, but we don't get any of that at all. So that's kind of interesting. I'm not sure if he's just trying something different or if he's purposely not using that, kind of saving it for maybe some more special moments. I'm not sure. I will also say that, you know, the colors are absolutely spectacular, but I did say it was Jordi Belair on colors, so there's no surprise there. Just like in the first issue, a lot of reds, a lot of kind of yellows and oranges, which gives it this menacing feel. And I have a feeling that we're going to find out why it's that way, because you certainly notice that kind of color palette in the action scenes. And again, that's what makes me think there's something more than meets the eye, because if you pay close attention to when that color palette is used, there seem to be some things that those pages and panels have in common, as opposed to when the colors are a little more true to their actual color, as opposed to having that kind of reddish overtone. So really, really great start on these first couple issues. The only complaint I'd have is that it was so fast paced. It was over before I knew it. And I was like, oh man, I got to wait 2 weeks again. So really, really fantastic job. I would not be surprised to see Wonder Woman climbing up the sales charts for DC based on the quality of these first couple of issues from this creative team. What do you got up next, Manny?
I've got Dark Knight's Death Metal number 3 by Scott Snyder, Greg Capullo, Jonathan Glapion, and FCO, and colors by FCO Placencia. So we are the third issue through this Death Metal event. And in a nutshell, we are saving Superman. That's the mission that Batman, Harley, Wonder Woman, and Swamp Thing on a Stick are working on at the moment. At the same time, we have the Flashes realizing that they need to stay away as far as they can from the, I don't know what you want to call them anymore, the Batman who laughs, whatever he is, in order for him not to get all that power. But in order, first and foremost, in order for them to have any type of chance to survive, they need Superman. And we find Superman on a kind of like a cosmic motorcycle or something like that, where if he takes his feet off of it, there's a certain type of dark version of kryptonite that will kill him. And it's made by Mr. Miracle, so it is said to be unescapable. And it is, and it's being controlled by like a dark side Batman. And let me tell you something, Jace. Like,
is it getting kind of hard to keep track of all these crazy ideas?
Like, they have an atrocious Batman in this one. They have like a Brainiac Batman. I mean, what, the first few issues we saw like a T-Rex Batman.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? I'm like, Batman's my favorite character, but this is like overdoing it. And like, now there's a dark side Batman and he's using a gun. And so, anyway, point is, I just want to get that off my chest, because I just, like, I don't know. There's so many other characters in the DC universe, and I get that Batman sells, but Jesus Christ, like, now there's a King Robin, which could have been cool, but I don't know. It's just so much Batman, and I'm just so absolutely sick of it. With that being said, the way this issue develops was really entertaining. I enjoyed the way that they're able to go and get Superman in the issue. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what it is Lobo's after, and then also the other thing is, like, the Flashes are running, and that's what they have to do. It just makes me laugh. I don't read a lot of Flash, but a lot of times when I see the Flashes, it's like, well, what do you need to do? Well, just run. So that's kind of odd. But I will say that it was a breath of fresh air to see Jarro and Batman come back together. It's like... It's a pairing that I never want to see them, like, break apart. Like, even after this is all said and done, Jarro should be the next Robin for a couple of arcs. Because, like, I mean, gosh, like, if you really think about it, ever since they destroyed the homeworld, the planet with Starro, like, Jarro's been involved in so much. And it's crazy. I don't understand Snyder's love for Jarro, but I mean I don't understand it, but I get it because I like it. Like when I'm flipping through the pages and I'm annoyed of the different Batmans, it's like, oh look, it's Jarro, and then Batman hugs him. Like, what is that? But it's great. I love it because he's a starfish, and then their plan that involves him makes so much sense. So it's weird. I don't really know how I feel about this issue because I'm annoyed about a lot of things the way it's developing, but at the same time it has some really cool moments. One that I can't talk about because it'll pretty much ruin the whole book. I'm not even going to insinuate what it is, and I was just like, oh. Anyway, good artwork. I'm kind of digging the whole Superman with the long hair and the like kind of rock arm. He looks kind of badass. I'll tell you that. So I don't know. It's maybe also because there's not a lot of like Batman who laughs in this actual book. There's just other characters. I found it entertaining. So or not bad. It flows, definitely flows better than the other two issues, I think. And so it's easier to read.
What's the which of the three has been the worst issue so far?
The first one.
And the second one got better and the third one better?
Yeah. I hate saying that too because like I read it and I was like, dang, like this is okay. I can stand this. This is all right. Yeah, just because I think it also has to do with the fact that the first issue, if you haven't been keeping up with a lot of the things, which you know some people don't, it's just I felt it was just really hard to get into because it's like, what the hell is going on? Like, what is Jonah? Like, why is Jonah Hex dead? Or like, what the hell is Lobo do? Anyway, there's a lot of things going on. And by this issue, kind of like everything just kind of like, it seems like they kind of slowed it down a little bit and without having to sacrifice much of the action that is necessary. And so, things are starting to really unwind for the better, and then by the end of it the plot thickens. So now I'm very curious. I'm very excited for the next issue, which I didn't think was going to happen, especially after that wonderful podcast we did for issue number one.
Yeah, I still haven't read number two yet. The first one I thought was okay, and I saw a lot of people giving it 10 out of 10 online. I certainly don't feel like it was a 10.
I don't think so either. And the thing is, I was replying to some things from one of our local comic shops, and there were some people like almost like afraid to come out of the woodworks and be like, "Hi, I didn't like it either." And I was like, "Okay, great, I'm not alone." So a little bit of support there.
Yeah, it was kind of strange. I mean, I don't think it's as bad as some of the reviewers out there are saying. That, you know, they're saying that this is like horrible dreck, and I mean, because at the end of the day, it's Snyder and Capullo, and they know that they're going completely over the top. Right. You know, they know that they're kind of throwing everything at the wall, including the kitchen sink, and just having a blast. But there are things about it that you know, when I just flipped through it, I didn't necessarily like. I'm not a fan of these kind of the pages that are like dividers.
Oh yeah, no, I don't like those either.
It's like, dude, you're just recycling art. Like, it's the same page without color, or, you know, with minimal color. Like, just give me another page of story. You're always complaining you don't have enough real estate to tell the story you want to tell, and then you're wasting. I mean, how many mm-hmm. of them do we get in here? Like three, I think.
I think it was three.
Yeah, there's two. I mean, I didn't, like I said, I didn't read it because I haven't read two yet. But I just flipped through it and I noticed, oh, they're still doing these things. So yeah, we get three of them in there. So that, I mean, that's three more pages of story we could have gotten.
That's a lot.
Yeah, or you could have, made the book smaller and charged me less. So yeah, I'm not digging on those kind of chapter dividers or whatever they are. But yeah, I do need to get caught up. The other thing that I want to mention about this that I noticed, so in the back of this book, I have said quite a few times about the first Dark Knight Metal series about how I felt like it was completely front-loaded and started off really well. And then the last 3 months, all the tie-ins were over, and we just got, like, you know, part three or part four, part five, part six. And because it was front-loaded like that, it felt like it kind of limped into the finish line, and it didn't feel like, by the time it was over, it didn't feel like a thing anymore. I don't know if DC listened to me or what, but this thing is completely the other way. It's completely backloaded. So we got one issue in June. We got issue two in July. So issue Dark Knight's Death Metal 1 in June, Dark Knight's Death Metal 2 in July. In August, we got, last week, Dark Knight's Death Metal Legends of the Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. This week, we got Dark Knight Death Metal number 3. Next week, we have Dark Knight Death Metal Guidebook number 1. In September, we've got Death Metal Trinity Crisis 1. We've got a Justice League 53 Doom Metal Part 1 tie-in. We've got a Death Metal Speed Metal number 1 tie-in. And we have a Death Metal Multiverses End. So the first 2 months, we had one book. August, we had 3. September, we have 4. October, we have Death Metal 4. Justice League 54 and 55, which is Doom Metal Part 2 and 3. And then we have another special, Death Metal Robin King number 1, and a Death Metal Rise of the New Gods number 1. So we have 5 in October. Then in November, Jesus, we've got two more Justice Leagues, Justice League 56 and 57, Doom Metal Part 4 and Part 5. We have a Death Metal Infinite Hour Extreme special. We have Death Metal Itself number 5, and we have Death Metal The Multiverse Who Laughs number 1. So 5 in October, another 5 in November, and then in December, we've got Death Metal The Secret Origin number 1, Death Metal The Last Stories of the DCU number 1, Death Metal Itself number 6, and Death Metal The Last 52 War of the Multiverses number 1, and then in January, we finish up with Dark Knight's Death Metal number 1. So this is really backloaded. I mean, we start off with one issue in June, one in July, 3 in August, 4 in September, 5 in October, 5 in November, 4 in December, and then 1 in January. And, you know, December has Christmas, January, I mean, I imagine it'll be the first week in January and follow right on the heels of the last book in December. So it's exact opposite of last time, where this one kind of started off kind of slow, and everything is backloaded. We've got, what is it, 1, 2, 3, 4, a 5-part Justice League story that fills in, and I've been really curious to know who's going to write Justice League. Venditti left, we think, for something that was Generations related, and that whole thing got thrown out because of Didio's firing. And then Cy Spurrier came on for an arc. And then Joshua Williamson has taken over because he's doing the Death Metal thing with this 5-part that runs through Justice League 57. But then who's on Justice League after that? Is Williamson going to continue? Is Venditti going to come back? We don't know. I mean, we don't really know much about it. With all the news that came out about DC that we talked about at the top of the podcast and all these issues, like, I knew Death Metal was, you know, it was kind of feeling like a bigger event than last time. And I don't know that it necessarily is if you went and counted up all the tie-ins and the one-shots for the different evil Batman, if this is more than last time or not. Maybe it feels like a little more, but maybe it's just because I'm seeing this whole checklist at once. But it does feel like a lot. So I guess we'll wait and see how it's received. I am kind of curious. I've been meaning to read. I'm trying to make time to read issue 2, and I want to read issue 3, especially because you say it's getting better. And when I flipped through it, it looked interesting. But the last question I'll ask you about it, because Snyder has said all along that Dark Knight's Death Metal is a Wonder Woman story, not a Batman story. But when I flipped through it, like you were talking about, I see a hell of a lot of Batman. So do you feel like it's a Wonder Woman story, or you still feel like it's a Batman story like the first Death Metal was?
It's definitely led by Wonder Woman, the efforts to, but at the same time, Batman is doing he's kind of overshadowing it a little bit, and it might just be the fact that everywhere you look, whether it's good or bad, there's a bat signal. I think that Harley even mentions it in the book. She said, he's like, damn, like you got, like, even if you're a bad guy, you're so good at branding. And he over the years, he puts a bat on everything, you know. Don't you remember the famous George Clooney the bat visa or the bat card? Don't leave home without it. That was great. And so it looks like they do try to focus on Wonder Woman, and I do dig her hair, by the way, because I don't know if you get a chance to flip it, where it's really, really like dark black, and then it fades into like a blue, and then it goes to white. She just looks cool. She does definitely stand out. But there's just so much Batman in it that I feel like it almost drowns her out.
Yeah, I guess I guess we'll see. Part of the problem is that, you know, all the villains are Batman. You know.
Yeah, it's so,
like you were saying, Batman Darkseid. Yeah. Isn't there a Batman? God, what the heck, Atrocitus?
Yeah, that's what I mentioned. He was working with the Batman Brainiac, and I was like, what the hell?
It's enough at this point. So, all right, well, let's move on. Next book I want to talk about from Marvel, Amazing Spider-Man number 46, from writer Nick Spencer. Pencils by Marcello Ferreri. Inks by Roberto Poggi. I hope I'm saying that right. It's P-O-G-G-I. Colors by David Curiel, and letters by Joe Caramagna. So this is Sin's Rising Part 2, which is the return of the Sin Eater. I talked about the first part previously, and I talked about how I wasn't a big fan of the Sin Eater the first time he came around, because I felt like him kind of about how I feel about the Joker. Like, Spider-Man should be able to beat him in like 30 seconds, because it's just a regular guy with no superpowers with a shotgun, and he's got, you know, a ski mask on and jeans and a sweatshirt. Like, what? How's this any different than any mugger that's been out there, right? So, wasn't a fan the first time he came around. But he's been off the stage for a long, long time, dead. But we know in comics, nobody ever stays dead. And also, it's the return of Mark Bagley on Spider-Man as artist. First time on Amazing Spider-Man in a long time. I think he said 20 years on the interview that I saw that he did for Comic-Con at Home. So if you just heard me give the credits, it's not even, we're only on the second issue of this. We're only on part 2, and already it's a different penciler, not Mark Bagley. Mark Bagley does do the variant cover, but man, I wanted at least 2 issues in a row with Mark Bagley. And that's not to say that Marcello Ferreira's art is bad by any stretch of the imagination. It's actually really, really good. There's an action scene kind of throughout almost the whole issue where Spider-Man fights the Lethal Legion. This version of the Lethal Legion has Count Nefaria, the Grey Gargoyle, Whirlwind, and Count Nefaria. And the action scenes are really, really great. If there's any complaint I have about the art, the panels are kind of small. He tends to put, you know, quite a few panels on the page. And so they do feel a little crowded. I wouldn't mind if the art got a chance to breathe a little more, but that might just be the direction he's getting from Nick Spencer. because we do get a big chunk of story here, and the way it's laid out maybe lends itself to having a lot of panels be necessary. So that being said, I hope that if Marcelo does more issues of Spider-Man, that maybe it's a less dense issue where he gets a chance to kind of showcase his art a little more, because I think with larger panels, the detail he puts into his art would get a chance to shine a little more, and it wouldn't feel so cramped. I mean, it doesn't feel crowded and it doesn't feel muddy, because he does have pretty good line work, and his line weights are relatively light. But it like begs to be blown up, you know, so you can see a little more. So I really did enjoy the art overall, though, and I thought the color work was done really well also by David Curiel. I mean, I was talking about in the Sin Eater special, as well as Sin Rising Part 1, about the darker palette that had been used with the Sin Eater stories to kind of convey kind of a darker tone, because the Sin Eater that's somehow returned from the dead is definitely a dark character. That being said, this issue, we've got Spider-Man fighting supervillains, and it does have a little more primary feel in the palette, a little more classic, you know, bright kind of Spider-Man tone. As far as the story itself, like I said, I went on record as saying I wasn't a fan when I heard they were bringing the Sin Eater back. I wasn't a fan of the Sin Eater the first go round. Don't think he's a very good character. So that being said, Nick Spencer is doing more with the Sin Eater than has ever been done before, and I found myself pretty early on in this issue going, "Okay, I get it. I get that you're bringing the Sin Eater back, and what Spencer is doing by kind of leveling the Sin Eater up and making him more powerful makes him a very good Spider-Man villain, and one that I hope doesn't, if he hangs around, doesn't get overused. But he would be somebody that could show up like every 2 or 3 years as kind of a big bad, you know, and be a really interesting foe for Spider-Man to go up against, because it's not even, and I don't want to give away too much, but it's not even that Spider-Man has to face the Sin Eater as we see in this issue, but he has to face what the Sin Eater stands for and how that has changed in terms of what the world is like now. You know, this was back in the 90s, late 90s, I think, when the Sin Eater, maybe mid 90s, when the last time we saw the Sin Eater, I think it was late 80s when he first came on the scene, and then when he got out of prison or out of the mental hospital, wherever he was, and he showed up for that final arc where he died, I think it was in the mid 90s. But he's been gone all this time. The world has changed a lot since then, since, you know, those first two big story arcs with Sin Eater. So the way the world sees him is much different now. And so Spidey is kind of facing a battle he can't win in terms of the way the world sees the Sin Eater and what that means. And it's something that feels very classic Spider-Man, you know, him going up against a situation where he's kind of powerless, you know. He's always going to be the little guy. It's like a war of hearts and minds. It's like him in the classic Spider-Man stories when he had as an antagonist the Daily Bugle newspaper itself, right, with J. Jonah Jameson writing editorials about him being a menace and whatever. Like, you can't fight that, you know. There's no way to fight against that. It's an ideology. It's an outlook. And there's, you know, you can't, you know, beat it in a fight or trap it in webs and throw it in jail. You know, it's not that kind of foe. And so that's the dynamic that Spencer has added to the Sin Eater that I find really interesting, along with kind of leveling up his powers. So really, really spectacular job. Really, really great job by Nick Spencer. He totally won me over. Like, I heard the Sin Eater was coming back, I was like, really? But yeah, he's doing a really fantastic job. All right, what do you have up next, Manny?
That's actually all I had for today.
All right. Well, I'm going to talk about a couple more things, like super, super quick. Immortal Hulk number 36 from writer Al Ewing, pencils by Joe Bennett, inks by Ryu Jose, and colors by Matt Milla, letters by Corey Petit. Immortal Hulk just continues to be really, really good. Those Alex Ross covers are amazing, and this is this whole issue is basically one big fight, and it's totally awesome. We see Absorbing Man, we see Titania, we see Rick Jones is not in a good place, I'll say, and it moves the narrative forward. But it's an interesting pacing because it is one big fight. It does move really quickly, but you do feel like in terms of moving the story forward, this is kind of one of those bridge issues that is kind of setting something up. We had a big event happen at the end of the previous issue. We're going to have something big happen at during the next issue, I would imagine, based on what happens in this issue. So Immortal Hulk continues to be really, really good. I don't hear as many people talking about how good it is as we used to, and I think that's just because it's been around for 3 years now, and it's so good that people mm-hmm. are starting to take it for granted a little bit, and kind of everybody's on board. So I just want to remind everybody that it's absolutely amazing. And the one other thing that I want to mention is there is a really cool scene where Hulk is punching Titania, and in the background of this scene, Joe Bennett, he incorporates the name of a very famous and wonderful classic Hulk artist in the background. And I didn't notice it when I read it the first time, but when I flipped back through and was looking at the art, it jumped out at me. I was like, how did I miss that the first time? That's so cool that Joe Bennett is giving a shout out to one of the greatest Hulk artists ever, in my opinion. So I thought that was really, really awesome. So if you do read it, if you do pick up Immortal Hulk, flip through and see if you notice it. And let me know on social media what you thought about that. If you don't read Immortal Hulk, then pick up the copy off your rack at your local comic shop and flip through it and see if you can spot the name. It's really cool. The last issue that I'll talk about is from IDW. It's G.I. Joe Real American Hero Snake Eyes The Origin. It reprints G.I. Joe Real American Hero numbers 26 and 27. These were the first two G.I. Joe comics I ever bought as a kid, and I had no clue that they were the origin of Snake Eyes, who I think just about everybody when they're a kid and they watch G.I. Joe thinks Snake Eyes is just the bee's knees. You know, he's like the coolest. And obviously, I watched the cartoon, and then I went to the little local corner store at my grandparents' house, and I saw the G.I. Joe comic, which I had seen on the rack before, but never bothered to pick it up. But you know, right there on the cover, the strangest secret of all, Snake Eyes, and so I picked it up. They had both issues there, so I picked up 26 and 27 and read them, and I was just enthralled. These were like my jam. They were so good, and so. Haven't seen them reprinted ever before, so both of them are reprinted here in one issue. Written by Larry Hama. Larry Hama handles the breakdowns for part one, and the finishes are handled by Steve Le Aloha, colors by George Russo's, and edited by Denny O'Neill. And then in the second part, story and breakdowns by Larry Hama, pencils by Frank Springer, inks by Andy Mushinsky, colors by George Roussis, letters by Rick Parker, edited by Denny O'Neill. So if you've never had a chance to read the story, if you don't know the origin of Snake Eyes, you know, this doesn't tell us everything, but it's classic mid-80s comics. It's the dialogue can be a little cheesy. It can be a little wordy with exposition or whatever, but it's a really fun story. It was a great trip down memory lane for me. Like it just brought back like so many memories there, especially because there's this one scene with a hoodlum with a pistol that like as soon as I turned the page to it, I was like, oh yeah, I remember this. Such a great example of sequential storytelling and really fun. So, you know, I think everybody loves Snake Eyes. Anybody who's a fan of G.I. Joe loves Snake Eyes. And like I said, this doesn't give you everything, but it does give a lot of background and kind of an overview of who Snake Eyes is, how he gets hurt, why he wears the mask, how come he can't talk. Like, all that stuff is answered here. So right now we have Snake Eyes Dead Game by Rob Liefeld coming out. So I guess they felt like it was a good idea to put out this reprint of the origin. So yeah, really, really cool. And great to see that classic Larry Hama art. So I just wanted to mention that as well. All right, well, let me give a rundown of some of the other books that you might want to be interested in that come out today. Starting with Aftershock. We obviously already mentioned two of them, but Undone by Blood, number 5, is also out on stands from Aftershock Comics today. Over at DC, we've got Batman and the Outsiders, number 15. We've got Flash, number 759. Hawkman, number 26, from Robert Venditti. Superman, number 24, where he teams up with Dr. Fate, is on stands today as well. Meanwhile, over at Image, Adventure Man, number 3, from the Dodsons, as well as Oblivion Song, that's Robert Kirkman's book, number 26. Still have all the Empire stuff going on over at Marvel. So Empire number 5 of 6 is out today. Empire Avengers number 2. Empire Captain America number 2. Empire X-Men number 3. We've also got Marauders number 11. And Star Wars Darth Vader number 4. Also, Venom number 27 from Donny Cates continues to be a really great seller. And that's out today as well. So those are some of the books you might want to be on the lookout for at your local comic shop, in addition to the ones Manny and I spoke about in a little more detail. So I think that's going to do it for this episode. As always, we want to thank everybody for joining us. Anything else to add, Manny?
Nope, I'm good.
All right. Well, like I said at the top of the show, I will be on a YouTube Live later today, what have you, to talk about all the crazy happenings at DC. So if you want to know what time and get a link to the YouTube Live, just be sure and check Twitter, Instagram, and all the social media. So thanks for listening, as always, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time. You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.